Have a great week. Bye for now.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a soul?
The wonders of the electronic age. I hit the mute button and missed the introduction to our show. So we'll start again. That was Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song. Back with you here. We got a killer hour to go through with the astonishing outcome of these elections, the amazing outcome in Virginia. But we're going to really have to deal now with the possibility that the Republican Party is going to not honor the outcome of the vote in Kentucky, where they lost the governorship, but are talking about a coup d'etat. So I have the two great experts that come with us so frequently and fruitfully on this show. John Brakey, are you with us?
I certainly am. Pleasure to be here.
Steve Rosenfeld, are you here?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi. Hi, everyone.
Oh, good. So you were here and I wasn't. I put the cell phone in my pocket to walk upstairs and apparently hit the mute button. So here we are. We are back in touch. And John Brakey, you are, I have become one of the great election protection activists in all of U.S. history. And Steve Rosenfeld, you are writing as much as anyone ever has on the phenomenon of election theft in this country and protecting our elections. And here we have something that is, just when you thought it couldn't get any crazier with these Trump Republicans, they're going to, I almost hope, I mean, you guys can say what you think, I almost hope that they try to steal this governorship in Kentucky. I mean, I assume that that would be a wake-up call for a lot of people. John Brakey, what do you know about Kentucky and this outcome, and what do you think is about to happen?
Well, you know, it's Kentucky. You know, my good friend and lawyer, Bill Reisner, comes from Kentucky. And
yeah.
And that's where he first learned how election fraud really works. But the election fraud that he dealt with and his father dealt with was more on a retail level, where we're fearful of a wholesale level, and who are the people programming this stuff and doing things, you know, in that state. But it really comes down to how close this election was, and then the election chicanery that can come out of this by using some kind of a law to get him into the House, and then the Republican majority can decide, it really was the people wanted a conservative, and then turn around and blame the Libertarian Party for getting 2% of the vote. Who knows what kind of games they're going to play, but I'm interested to hear Steve's viewpoint, because I know he's more studied than I am on this. Hi, Steve.
Hey.
All right, Steve, give us the scoop. I assume you've been camped in Kentucky for the last couple of months. Tell us what you know about what's going on there and what we can expect.
Well, it's interesting. The latest that's happened today is that there might be some cracks in what was looking yesterday like a bit of a legislative coup. And what I mean by that is there have been some Republican legislators today who say, well, you know, come on, Governor, if you don't really have any evidence that things are, were wrong or stolen, then you should accept the results and not put us through this nonsense. So that's interesting, because usually, you have to speak with one voice if you're going to do these kinds of, power plays and power grabs. So we'll see what happens there. You know, the thing about it is I've been looking at what some of the lawyers, the election law experts, have been saying, and there are arguments to be made on both sides of whether that state legislature can get away with doing this. Now, there will be arguments, and it will go into court, undoubtedly, if they try this. And what is this? Well, they have peculiar laws in that state where they don't have recounts, apparently, for the governor and lieutenant governor. Instead, it kind of gets bounced to the state legislature, and then they have a process there. And in many ways, this is sort of an artifact of the template created around the Electoral College. And that's what I was trying to look at to see, you know, what could be precedent setting here, because if they could get away with this in Kentucky now, then what might be stopping, you know, red trifecta states from saying, we're just going to, you know, assign our own electors regardless of what the popular vote is next November. That's kind of what I was trying to feel into today a little bit. But what the lawyers are saying is it's actually going to be harder for them to pull this off in Kentucky than it would be to do that at the Electoral College level. So we could talk about that some more. But, you know, this whole thing is like, you know, the Republicans are utterly shameless. They will do anything they can to sustain or grab or, you know, their power. And you know, we'll hear all kinds of, you know, technicalities and arguments that are, you know, with a lot of vehemence. But, I mean, you know, this is there's been no race, not a single one that I've asked about, where somebody has basically come back from a 5,000-vote deficit, you know, through a recount and ended up winning. So so just fact.
Well, there's a trim on that. There was we've had outright theft attempted and to a certain extent pulled off in North Carolina. And it was also done in Wisconsin a few years ago, where Scott Walker, the fascist governor there, had apparently lost. And then miraculously, a poll worker found enough votes on a laptop to make him governor again. And, of course, the Democrats just rolled over and said nothing. Now, we're finally to the point where in Kentucky, because the whole world basically is watching this one, that the Democrats might actually, you know, bestir themselves to fight over this one. John Brakey, what do you think?
Well, you know, it makes me think that when you were saying about Wisconsin, that was Waukesha County, okay, which is a highly Republican party, runs that county, and that was the elections administrator found the missing votes on her laptop. Okay.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and I remember what we went through when we went there for the recount, you know, in 2016, and finally realizing that the joke that came out of it, if you're in Wisconsin and you're in a bad election, you've been Waukesha'd, okay, and referring to that county. And it's just that historic. I mean, it's just it's alarming what happened in this election, which could symbolize what is coming, okay, both ways. I mean, you know, you look at Kentucky, that's a state that's only like 24 or 25% digital. They're using a lot of old technology. Elections really are not verifiable if you can't, because they're using DREs, and it's a mess. And it seems like a lot of the states under Republican control, like Tennessee, you know, the same problem exists there. Another state, Indiana. But, you know, the really big story that's coming out of this election is maybe what happened in Pennsylvania. And when we get ready, we'll talk about that. But Kentucky is something to watch to see what's going to happen next.
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, I think that Wisconsin race you're talking about, wasn't that a state Supreme Court justice, not the governor's race from Waukesha County?
You know, I think you're right. It was that. You're right.
So anyway, just
yeah.
But so the thing about it is this. You have this curious trend, kind of you know, the pendulum historically bounces back, you know, between federal rights and states' rights, you know, around voting questions. So, you know, we're sort of moving back into the states' rights zone. And, you know, and we see this around redistricting, for example. So in North Carolina and in Pennsylvania, you know, state constitutions have been cited to basically redraw these districts in ways that actually elect more Democrats because it's more representative of the actual demographics and voting populations. So now you have, you know, kind of a curious thing around, you know, well, you know, what, you know, how do you resolve, you know, or, you know, these finish line issues, whether they're fabricated or not. I mean, these guys are clearly fabricating the fact that they don't want to surrender power. And there's been no evidence put forth so far. And the only implication out of Kentucky was that it affected one form of balloting that basically had, there's actually a paper trail, which is absentee ballots. So it'll be really interesting to see, because this guy, you know, every other statewide office was won by Republicans. So and you know, so it's one of those things where, you know, how can one, you know, he's an unpopular governor. But, you know, the whole thing here is, can they use a legislative process to try to subvert or overturn the popular will or popular vote? And what ends up happening is you get these lawsuits, these legal cases where you have some federal precedent where it goes to federal court, where you're not able to change the rules, you know, in the middle or after the game, which is kind of what the other side would argue here. What I am most interested in about this is, I, you know, it's beginning to sound like his coalition is beginning to crack, although who knows what will happen. But I'm wondering how applicable something like this might be for 2020, because actually everything I've seen is that at the Electoral College there are far less checks and balances. And, you know, the Bush v. Gore decision said that no state, you know, is required to use the popular vote to, you know, to choose their electors. So if you look at, like, the states that have what are called trifectas, or it means, you know, the single party controls both chambers of the legislature and the governors, well, you've got, you know, a bunch of swing states, 2020 swing states, and, you know, they're, I mean, what we're talking about, Georgia, Florida, Arizona, Ohio. I mean, you know, right. Could they try to pull something like that, you know? And so I'm, you know, in this climate, I you know, Harvey, you said you don't know what to expect. I mean, I expect anything and everything.
Yes. Well, I'm going to, you know, part of me says, bring it on. I mean, the 10 years ago, or, you know, or 15 years ago when we first started breaking these stories and everybody was laughing at us,
right,
you know, saying, oh, elections that can't be stolen, blah, 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 dating right to Florida 2000 and Ohio 2004, that was one thing. But we've, you know, some people have actually realized, of course, they would never say we were right. They would just say, oh, look what we found out, you know, being them, elections are being stolen. So it seems to me that if the Republicans go ahead and try and pull this off in Kentucky, that the whole country is going to explode.
Well,
I mean, am I overestimating?
I mean, Harvey, I think you're right. I think bringing it on would actually be the best possible thing for 2020, because it would show everybody, you know, like the art of the possible here. And, you know, it would say, hey, this is what we're dealing with yet again.
Yes. And, you know, maybe the websites that blacklisted us for implying that the elections were stolen would restore us. But, you know, the bottom line here is that I will be astounded if they are stupid enough to try and steal this in Kentucky. But, you know, what they've been doing in North Carolina is darn near what they're talking about doing here in Kentucky. And we'll see where else. I guess we'll know in a couple of days. Of course, they've got it here in Ohio now.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about this is, if you think about this, Harvey, this, you know, this is not coming out of nowhere, this conversation we're having. In the last couple of years, in states like North Carolina, the legislature has basically tried to, you know, change the composition of the state, that state's Supreme Court. This has happened in other states too. You know, you have
well, Wisconsin also.
You have a series of this, you know, sort of like, you know, legislative, you know, coups or, you know, or like power grabs that, so this is not like it's just coming out of nowhere. It's actually kind of like incrementally ramping up. We're not like fabricating this stuff up or being hypothetical or being like paranoid or conspiratorial. I mean, you know, these are facts.
Yes, but this time they've crossed over into the to the realm of the highly visible. You know, I mean,
right.
They've done this all sub rosa. There wasn't much coverage of what they were doing in North Carolina. There wasn't much coverage of when the Democrat got elected governor in Wisconsin.
Right.
You know, the legislature did a lot of this stuff, but they did not try to reverse the actual gubernatorial decision by the public. This is really an assault on the actual outcome, and the whole world is watching this one. You know, I still have to fault Al Gore. I mean, if he'd have fought this out in Florida 2000, yeah. You know, this kind of stuff wouldn't be going on. But here we are, 20 years later, it's now just complete. It could not be more visible, this thing in Kentucky. And
yeah, I mean,
let's see how far. We know that Trump is going to come out and start giving speeches about how the election was stolen in Kentucky and that the legislature needs to reverse this. And his base will buy into it. But I don't know, man. This looks to me like a bridge too far. And I hope that they jump off it. What do you think, Brakey?
You just don't know what they're going to do next. I mean, we're seeing in Republican states, you know, them holding out to try to get the worst type of voting machines. I mean, you know, it looks like that they're in on the heist, at least by being accomplices to the election fraud and election chicanery, voter suppression, gerrymandering. You know, they might do this in order to get more people just to be distasteful and untrustworthy, because when it comes right down to it, if you look at these elections, voter turnout still was maybe just a little higher. So what does that mean? That means maybe 60-70% of the people who could have voted didn't vote. In a presidential, we know that was 44%. And how much is voter suppression getting people to believe in what Mark Twain said? If elections made a difference, they wouldn't let us do it. That kind of thing.
Yeah, but,
that's detrimental.
Let's address this term, voter turnout, for a minute. This has bothered me ever since, you know, 2000 and 2004. You know, there are all these commentators who go on, and there's this standard meme that voter turnout, people don't turn out to vote. How much of that is actually subtracting and repressing the vote when people turn up to vote and aren't allowed to vote, or their votes are pitched in the trash? I mean, how much, Steve Rosenfeld, is low voter turnout in fact fraudulent and being
I think you have to look at it state by state and look at, and you can't really generalize in a national way, because because Georgia is not California, and North Carolina and Ohio are maybe not as bad as Georgia was this last time, but North Carolina was right up there competing with it, you know, what happens is that. It's absolutely factually clear that hundreds of thousands of people in states like Ohio and Georgia and North Carolina and Missouri and even in Arizona, and this is 2018, 2016, you know, their either registrations or their, you know, the way they were listed on voter rolls was changed without their knowledge, and they weren't able to vote. I mean, you had hundreds of thousands of registrations held back from processing in Georgia, Missouri, and Arizona. Then you have, you know, these purges that are sloppily done and are disproportionately falling on Democratic epicenters as opposed to Republican epicenters. This is proven. McClatchy did prove this, you know, in investigative reporting in Ohio. It was also in North Carolina. It was also in Georgia. You have a state ballot initiative in Florida that says we're going to reenfranchise, you know, 1.4, 1.5 million former felons. The Republican legislature says no. It's now in court. So, you know, this stuff is real. But the thing is, when you say turnout, people still don't really feel like that there's a lot always to vote for. And voting on a Tuesday is not the most convenient things for people.
That's
the states
right.
with the highest turnout tend to vote by mail, or they have more early voting opportunities. You know, I looked at the Kentucky numbers, and somebody said something really, really interesting. So so this was, you know, like 1.4 million people voted for governor. It's a 5,000 plus or minus, you know, margin. You know, but statewide, that was 400,000 fewer people than in 2018 voting for president. So that state still could be, you know, very, very firmly in Trump's column if some large number of those 400,000 people who voted in 2016, you know, didn't vote this time around. You know, they could come back next year and vote, you know, overwhelmingly for Trump in that state. It just so happens that at this particular election, you know, that turnout was 400,000 less than the last one. So turnout's a funny thing, you know, and I what am I trying to say here? I'm trying to say you have to look at it state by state more than nationally. The numbers are still, you know, dismal compared to other countries, other Western countries. Part of that is because, you know, we don't move it to the weekend. We don't make it a holiday. We don't have easy access to a lot of places, you know, but some states are way better than others. So what I'm saying is it's hard to generalize, but we shouldn't even be having to have a discussion based on all these, you know, microaggressions that impede, you know, participation.
Well, you're going to assume, though, that the low turnout is more Democrats not voting than Republicans, wouldn't you, in this case?
Yes. Well, generally, I mean, this is really interesting. When you talk to people and you say, who's undecided? Who are the undecided people, you know, in America today? You know, so the question is, you know, you ask people this, are they undecided generally? What does that mean? Or like who are the swing voters? Is it really people who are undecided? And is it people who are infrequent voters? It turns out that undecided is really not a good word. There's something like 10 or 15% of the likely voting population that has not made up their mind, and mostly it's because they don't like either major party choice.
Well, they have made up their mind.
It's ambivalent about which. It's like pick your poison.
Right. So they have made up their mind. They just don't like either candidate.
Yeah, and they know they don't want to vote for a third party candidate because it's like a waste of time. So this is not the same, you know, narrative that we often hear, you know, that
400,000. I mean, generally, when there's an undervote, when you know there's a differential between the presidential elections and the off year elections, you generally assume that the bulk of the people who didn't vote would lean Democratic, especially for racial and class issues. But so who knows here in Kentucky, but this is not only.
Well, we don't know
that
that's true this year, Harvey, because, you know, the thing is, people, you know, the problem is it's really hard to ascertain trends when you get lots of anecdotal reports that are sort of one-off things. This is the problem with reporting on elections in general. You know, how does, like, one, you know, injury or aggression, you know, translate? Does it scale? Where does it scale? And because otherwise, you know, people blow things way out of proportion with their real impact. But there's a lot of anecdotal reporting, and you see this like in today's and yesterday's papers about the suburbs are just sick of Trump. They're just sick of the noise. They're sick of the craziness. They're sick of, you know, they're just tired of, you know, the Trump show. Thank God. But we'll see how, you know, how that plays out. I mean, we've got a year to go. The Democrats are perfectly capable of nominating, you know, the wrong people. And
right.
So it's just, you know, we just, you know,
we have a none of the above situation in the Democratic primary. For all the people who are running, there's nobody who's really grabbing anybody. I mean, the closest we're coming to is Elizabeth Warren. And, you know, she seems to be surging ahead. God help us if they nominate Joe Biden. I mean, I will guarantee you one thing right now. If the Democrats nominate Joe Biden, he will lose. I mean, he's ahead in the polls for the same reason that the Kardashians are famous. You know, the Kardashians are famous because they're famous. Biden's ahead in the polls because he's ahead in the polls. And, you know, people are supporting Biden because they think he can win because the polls show he's going to win. Which is ridiculous. He's completely unelectable. And I love Bernie dearly. I wish to God he could be president, but I don't think personally that this country, at least not at this point in time, is going to elect a Jewish guy to be president of the United States. I just don't think it's going to happen. And plus, he's 70-something and he's had a heart attack. So that leaves us Elizabeth Warren. She has a lot of pluses as far as I'm concerned. I do think she's marginally electable. But, you know, we'll see what happens. And the rest of them, forget it. I mean, people talking about Buttigieg, you know, I don't think the country will elect a gay guy either, frankly. Not at this point in time. And so I'm going to throw up a name here for you guys. And I want to have this discussion because it's somebody who I have thought for a long time could actually be elected president and would make a very good president. And so here's the name, Sherrod Brown. I think Sherrod Brown would make an excellent president. I think he's electable. He's genuine. I know I've known him for a long time. He's genuinely progressive. He's a New Dealer, basically. But, you know, he's acceptable to the corporate wing of the party. And I think he's the only Democrat who could carry Ohio. And I know he would carry Ohio. If Sherrod Brown were the nominee, he would definitely carry Ohio. So, and with it, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, maybe even Indiana, unless Pence is not on the ticket. So, having said that, John Brakey, what do you think? Sherrod Brown in 2020?
You know, that's interesting. I mean, you know, I'll be honest, I'm a track condition guy. I worry about the track conditions for the pony.
Yeah.
And I try not to get involved in the personalities. And if I do, I want to keep it private because, you know, I got to play a role. I work with all sides and it's important. And yeah, somebody says, what am I? I'm a progressive. Okay. And that's about as much as I really want to say. But the track conditions is what so I'm going to pass it off to Stephen.
Well, I do think, Harvey, that it's really true that there's the road to the White House goes through the Midwest, and there's, I don't have to tell you about the Midwest. You know, you lived in Columbus for a very long time, and you know,
I'm here now, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and both parties have neglected, you know, the Midwest for a long time. And quite frankly, you know, that's, you know, Trump's ability to identify people who are traumatized and most fearful and overpromise, you know, was the key to his success. And it's really, you know, it was interesting. You know, you had that fellow Tim Ryan, you know, as a candidate early on, who was just super angry and super blunt. And, you know, he wasn't really going to be speaking to, like, a national audience. But, you know, he was speaking for, you know, reflecting, you know, some of the energy that went to Trump or has in the past gone to Bernie about, you know, people who are basically overlooked and undervalued. So who is the candidate who can actually, you know, in a non-BS way, really talk to those people? And quite frankly, I think Elizabeth Warren is super articulate. But, you know, I've in the past year when I've done reporting from some of these what will be swing states, I just don't know if a lot of these guys are going to vote for her. Their wives and daughters surely would. But, you know, you know, unless they say, well, my husband does the voting for our family, which people have said to me in Florida and in Georgia and to some extent in Pennsylvania. So I don't know. This is what makes it tough. You know, this is what, you know, makes it, you know, even harder. You know, and, you know, and then the other thing that's really went on Tuesday, which is something to pay attention to, is, you know, I'm on this conference call this morning listening to the DNC and their new, they have this, you know, battleground states plan. And they're just talking about how, well, we won, you know, not just in Pennsylvania and a couple places, but in the suburbs and places where, you know, at the local level, Republicans haven't been elected on and on and on and on and on. And they're saying this, you know, in an upbeat way about, you know, all these different states. And I'm thinking to myself, what are they not talking about? They're not talking about how a lot of these swing states are going to be voting on these new, using these new voting systems for the first time, and the public and the administrators are not familiar with them. There's going to be frustrations. There's going to be long lines. There's going to be breakdowns. No matter what, you know, the contractors, you know, are telling them now when they do their sales talks, and we saw some signs of that in a couple of different places. We saw it in Georgia, which is otherwise would be a swing state. We saw, you know, a handful of counties, you know, rural counties. This is black areas. You know, of course, you know, people couldn't check in because the computer poll books that do the voter roll check-ins did not match or work or sync with the so-called things that, you know, that pull up the electronic touchscreen ballots. We saw it in Pennsylvania where, you know, ES&S, the country's biggest vendor, was one of their models was also, it was presenting results that were so outside the box that people said we have to actually do recounts without even having anyone file. And, you know, this is the climate we're moving into. So, you talk about all these super tight races, and then you have, you know, and we try to game candidates, but then we have yet again, you know, like this. I'm telling you, the phone you're on, which is probably an iPhone, has, you know, more security and more technology, you know, than any voting system in America today. And it's ridiculous. And this is what we're going to be making these super high-stakes decisions with. And the early signs, you know, John can corroborate this, from Tuesday are not so hot.
Yeah.
I'm laughing, but yeah, it's not funny. It's actually astoundingly tragic.
And after all these years, we're entering the most important election in human history with an electoral system that's completely up for grabs.
Totally.
I mean, you know,
totally is.
The mechanics of the voting and of counting of the votes, since we have decided that we're not going to have paper ballots in this country, that it's totally up for grabs.
Well, they are paper. Of, you know, they're calling it paper, but it's not really. It's not the same as hand-marked human paper. This is a distinction that, you know, this is a bit of like sales talk propaganda. If a machine marks the ballot for you, you know, that means that it's interpreting your intent. And when a machine interprets your intent, that means it replaces the role of like a person having a human-made record and a jury being people actually, you know, sort of taking a second look if it's a close finish. Now, sometimes it's taking a second look at things that are kind of sloppy because people are people. But if you just turn this all over to computers just because we want to be efficient, and people don't know like what's going on behind the scenes, and we're seeing these programming errors. I mean, Harvey, this machine in Pennsylvania, John could talk about this, the Express Votes. There are a couple models. This is one of their models. It's running on Windows 7, for God's sake. Windows 7. You know, in 2019. God. And this machine is going to be with us supposedly for the next 12 or 13 years? And its operating system is Windows 7?
Well, what Windows are we up to now?
This is 10. Like 10 generations past that.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling. We're talking with two of the great election experts and activists in this country, John Brakey and Steve Rosenfeld. And, you know, let's take it another step further. All right, now are you ready for this one? I'm in Ohio. I came back here for many reasons, but the main one being that I have to tell this story because it leads us into the very worst nightmare
of the electoral process, which is physical intimidation. Okay? This, we're not talking about the Jim Crow South here. We're talking about Ohio. What happened in Ohio, we've had shows on this, and I'm sure you guys are well aware, the state legislature, which is completely corrupt, I mean, you know, bought and paid for. We have a utility in the north, in Akron, First Energy, which is a mob operation, and they are running two nuclear power plants. And I can't even begin to tell you how bad these nuclear plants are. I mean, these are Chernobyls waiting to happen, Perry and Davis Bessie, and they, of course, are losing money. And so First Energy went into the legislature, which they rigged in the 2018 election. First Energy had a specific agenda going into 2018. They actually attacked a number of incumbent Republicans and defeated them in the primaries in 2018 with the long-term plan of replacing them, which they successfully did, with other Republicans that they knew would vote for a big bailout for the nuclear plants. We did have a lot of Republican opposition to the bailout to the nuclear plants because we actually, I know it's hard to imagine, but we actually had some Republicans in Ohio who were free market Republicans from a previous century. So they set up the legislature to get themselves enough votes to and then they did all the usual bribing and misleading and all that crazy stuff, and they won HB6, which is a big bailout for the nuclear plant. Now we're headed towards an electoral situation. Immediately after they passed this bailout, the oil and gas industry, along with, you know, dragging the environmentalists behind the, you know, like cans behind a car. And they put up a referendum to reverse the bailout, which you can do under Ohio law. I mean, it's a very clear statute. But since the original statute was passed, they've thrown in a lot of bells and whistles to make it harder to get the referendum on, meaning that the Attorney General has to approve the language. So the attorney, you get 90 days to overturn the law. The Attorney General sat on it for 40 or 38. Actually, so you wind up with 52 days to reverse it. So then the company buys these insane, I mean, these are Monty Python ads showing how the Chinese are trying to take over the electric grid by repealing the bailout. But even through those ads, which are utterly ridiculous, the polls show a tremendous opposition throughout the state to this bailout for obvious reasons. This is a total ripoff. And even the media in Ohio, the Ohio newspapers, who are very conservative, were against the bailout and were appalled by these insane ads that were on TV. And here's where the rubber hits the road. So the opponents of the bailout, in order to get the referendum on the ballot, need about 250,000 signatures validated. They started hiring people. I mean, it's a luxury to have money in a situation like this, because it's oil and gas, they started hiring people. And when the people that they hired went into the field to gather signatures to put this referendum to repeal the bailout on the ballot, they were physically assaulted by hired thugs from the nuclear industry. Now, this is a new level here. Wow. This we haven't seen since Jim Crow South. In Ohio, people who were paid signature gatherers, who were standing on street corners and at grocery stores and at college campuses, as we've been doing in the United States for centuries, gathering signatures for a legitimate state-approved referendum, were physically assaulted by thugs from the nuclear industry. Now, this is Germany in the 1930s. This is really serious stuff. And as a result of this, they did not get the signatures. They what should have been a slam dunk, which, you know, they could have gotten easily a million signatures to repeal this bailout. Everybody hates this bailout. But they physically assaulted people. What they would do, they called them blockers. We have videotape of one blocker assaulting a signature gatherer and kicking the, so the signature gatherer tried to take a picture with his cell phone, and they knocked the cell phone to the ground and stomped on the cell phone. And we've had situations where a single signature gatherer was surrounded by three of these blockers, and the blockers were intimidating the signature gatherer and, you know, yelling at people who were going to come sign the petition. This is something we could actually see in 2020 as well. I mean, in various forms. You know, they have, not only have they stepped over the line here in Kentucky with this governorship, we'll see if they do it, but this is really serious stuff. And we're going to hold a hearing on it on the weekend, and it's still in court. There are various aspects. The oil and gas people are challenging the delay that was imposed by the state in approving the referendum and trying to get the 38 days back to gather the signatures. But the signature gatherers are going to go into the field again and be again confronted with physical attacks. This is an attack on the referendum process. You know, is this what we're going to see in 2020, John Brakey, when you talk about the track, the conditions of the track? Are we going to see physical assaults?
I think that we're breaking new ground of how low our democracy is falling, and how dangerous this thing can really get, and how we have turned into such tribes, and it's scary. It really is. I fear for what could possibly happen, and that's what drives me to do the work that I do. That it's very important that we have elections that are transparent, trackable, and publicly verified. It's more important now that we prove to the losers, or at least to his disciples or followers, that he really lost. This thing could get really ugly.
Absolutely correct.
It really
could. You know, it's true. And, you know, Harvey, you know, your longtime co-author, Bob Fitrakis, I mean, he has a book coming out about the, you know, the emergence of, you know, of whites, the resurgence, rather, of white supremacists in Ohio. And he has told us both that, you know, these people are leafleting Trump rallies. And you know, and it, this is not made up stuff. You know, he encouraged people, he being the president, to take their, and the NRA, to take their guns to the polls in 2016. I mean, you know, this is, when we were at this Berkeley conference a couple of weeks ago, you know, the Barbara Arnwine, the longtime, you know, the former director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, she said her biggest concern was polling place violence in 2020. I mean, we're not making this stuff up.
Yep. No, and this is Germany in the 30s, and of course Trump is going to be increasingly desperate. I don't expect much to come out of the impeachment hearings, but you never know. You know, I think this Ukrainian stuff is very far afield from what really is understandable to the American public and what they are really caring about. And to me, of course, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Trump is in power because of the Democrats. The Democrats, we had Al Gore, we had the Clintons elected in 92 after Reagan Bush, and they delivered nothing. You know, there was no, they had the potential for the strongest economy in the history of the world. You had the two biggest economic windfalls in American history, the end of the Cold War and the rise of the computer revolution, which we dominated. And the Clintons had all this wealth at their feet and accomplished absolutely nothing in 8 years. And the gap that the Reagan really started, really Nixon did, but between rich and poor in this country, just got worse under Clinton. And we wind up with, an extra 600,000-700,000 people in prison because he escalated the drug war. Then you get Al Gore wins the election in 2000. And walks away. John Kerry wins the election in 2004 and walks away. In comes Obama. He again could make all the change in the world. And as far as I'm concerned, I always say this repeatedly, and it's in my new history book. I was just publishing my history, The People's Spiral of U.S. History. I'm going to say that if Barack Obama had not escalated the war in Afghanistan, if he had instead pulled us out and used those resources to benefit the people at the bottom who are now rallying for Trump, the angry, frustrated working middle class has been screwed. You know, there hasn't been a piece of, except for Obamacare, which is marginal, and the stimulus package, which, you know, basically went away, there has been zero social legislation to help working middle class people in this country since Vietnam. You know, we've had nothing in the last 50 years of benefit to anybody except the super rich. If Obama had not gotten us into Afghanistan deeper and instead pulled out and used those resources to help working people, Donald Trump would not be in the White House. It wouldn't even be close. And then, of course, you have Hillary Clinton winning the election in 2016 and walking away and not saying a word except to yell at Jill Stein. So, you know, this is where we're at now. We have a fascist in the White House, and we're looking at a definitive election. And as you say, John, we're going in with a rigged track. And, and you know, if this Kentucky insanity helps people look more closely at what you guys have been working on here in terms of the mechanics of the election, that would be helpful. But, geez, I mean, we're really up against it here. John, do you see is making progress anywhere?
I do see the progress. It's just, can we get enough people to jump in? You know, hey, listen, 78% of the country right now is digital with images, okay, that could prove if elections are real or not, okay? And but what's happening? They're being destroyed. These are the actual documents these voting machines counted. They don't count the ballot. They count the picture. It's generated the chain of custody. It's evidence, and it's allowed to be destroyed. And then it's very hard to get at the originals. You look at what happened in Pennsylvania on these express votes are very interesting. There was a three-way race. Do people go ahead? One guy who ran before, who's a well-known Democrat, wound up, after 105 precincts were called in, with only 164 votes, he wound up, after the recount, they found an additional 25,000 votes, or 26,000, and he turned out that he won. And you have to ask yourself, well, if they're doing these logic and accuracy tests, and they're as good as they say they are, how could this have happened? Unless there was a background program that may have got triggered. It could be a number of things. That's why we need elections that are transparent, trackable, publicly verified. That's why those images are important. That's where we can count them independently and maybe get more people to believe in our democracy, that it really does matter, voting, if we can prove that it's real. And that's the job we want to do. We want to make elections that way by giving it a tetanus shot called transparency. You know, that's the ultimate goal. I'll turn it back over after that.
Steve?
Well, John's really correct. And, you know, the thing is, we have a new generation of voting technology where basically two things are happening. People are saying, people who are pushing the technology are saying there's going to be more and more of a paper record. Now, whether it's generated by computer or by hands, let's just push that to the side for a second. Obviously, I think it's much more important to have, you know, a human traceable action. But then what you have these systems where they're not literally, nobody's looking at the piece of paper. What's happening is software is analyzing each page as a grid, and it's basically associating the grid coordinates with candidate choices. And this is happening at the precinct level, and then what happens is that kind of aggregates like a pyramid, like building blocks. Each is a brick as it gets all the way towards the top where you have like a central counting process. Well, what's happening is, you know, Harvey, you say like the Dems. Well, progressive activists, for the most part, who got involved after 2004 in Ohio, have been fighting anything involving computer records since then. And they have basically tried to kill, and in many cases have killed, the use of these ballot images as part of a record that can be examined in a double-checking process. Now, it's true that you can swap in digital images or digital files, but there's ways to to handle this in a little more in the fine print, where you can quarantine the batches and put in things that would actually, you know, like impede large-scale swaps and things like that, which I won't get into the details here. But people, but this, I mean, you can do this. One example, you could have images of ballots that have watermarks in them that are tied down to every local jurisdiction, like you have watermarks in financial documents. Nobody in the election world talks about this as a way to, as an anti-fraud, you know, authenticity, transparency, you know, anti-fraud, you know, activity. Instead, what's happening is, the best uses of new technology and older practices where, like, human activities, like juries, jurors, judgments, are being sidelined, and you have these contractors who are going in and basically running the show for these local officials, apart from the money that they're making, you know, through all these crazy contracts and maintenance and this, that, and the other. You read yesterday's accounts. You have officials in South Georgia and in Pennsylvania saying, oh, my God, my hair was red, but at the end of the day, it turned gray. Why did they say that? Because the contractors overpromised, their systems didn't sync, it didn't work, the transparency wasn't built into the process. And this is a microcosm of what we're heading into, and it's just so unnecessary. And what John is saying is completely correct. We need to be able to have losers be convinced that they lost. This guy in Kentucky, he cannot be convinced that he's lost. Now, maybe he's an egomaniac and he's a jerk and all these other things, but, you know, 5,000 votes separating in a statewide election. There has never been a recount that has overturned and reversed 5,000 votes. And I called people this morning asking about this in recent history. So we have to have systems where, like, the public can and the losing sides can accept that they lost.
Well, we know Donald Trump is never going to accept a loss. I mean, he's out of the White House, Donald Trump will go straight from the White House to the big house. I mean, you know, and he knows that. And so this, and everybody knows, we're exactly a year out from the election, and everybody knows that he is not going to leave voluntarily. And so the question then is, how many holes are they going to put in our democracy leading up to the election? You know, this is the key. And we're now down to physical intimidation. And, you know, this doesn't get any more serious. So,
well, you're correct about that. You are correct. And you're not the first person to make that observation either, by the way. And it's, you know.
No, but, you know, it's no longer theoretical. We have video of people in Ohio assaulting signature gatherers. I mean, that's where we're at now. And this is over a nuclear plant. Two nuclear plants, for God's sake. So don't get me going in that direction. So, you know, you guys are doing yeoman work here. And I think this Kentucky situation is spectacular. Even if they don't challenge it, they've certainly managed to raise the issue, you know, over a governorship in a state. And hopefully it throws Mitch McConnell's state into some kind of limbo as well. I can't let this go by without commenting either. You know, Jeff Sessions is going to run for the old Senate seat in Alabama. And on the one hand, okay, he's Jeff Sessions, a pretty unsavory character, but they have really made an enemy of him. And I'm almost intrigued to see him back in the Senate, you know. That would be pretty interesting. We've been talking with Steve Rosenfeld. Steve, what's your latest book?
Oh, my latest book is it's 2 years old. It's called...
Well, where do people get your stuff? Where do people read
your stuff? Well, my stuff can be seen... the easiest place to see it is probably on Salon, but I work for the Independent Media Institute, and they syndicate stuff. They syndicate, you know, my pieces to, you know, throughout what I call the lefty media ghetto. And some websites are more easily read than others. You know, I like the way stuff appears at Salon. I like the way stuff appears at National Memo. I like the way it appears, you know, Truth Dig. I like the way it appears at a bunch of places. But Independent Media Institute is, you know, they have links to everything.
All right, very good. And John Brakey, how do people get a hold of you and support your work?
First off, I just want to give a shout out to Stephen because I had his book right in front of me, and it is a great book, and it's called Democracy Betrayed, How Superdelegates, Redistricting, Party Insiders, and the Electoral College Rigged the 2016 Election. It's a great book. It tells a roadmap of what happened, because if you don't understand history, you're condemned to repeat it, and that could happen.
Well,
how to get a hold of
me
is...
Oh, go ahead. Do that.
Yeah, if you get a hold of me, my is johnbrakey@gmail.com. My site is easy. It's auditselectionsusa.org. You'll find me on Facebook as John Roberts Brakey or Audit USA. Thank you for having me on.
And thank you, guys. And I'll put in a plug my History of the United States, which is now called The People's Spiral of U.S. History, is actually pretty much done. I'm finalizing the physical stuff over the weekend. If you want a copy, email me at solartopia@gmail.com. This is a history of the United States I've been working on for 50 years. And you said the history, people who don't study history are condemned to repeat it. We have to quote Mark Twain as well. He said that history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And we are really watching a rhythm here. I'm going to keep having you guys on. You're great guests. And really doing spectacular work here. Thank you, crew in New York. And sorry for my cell phone glitching out a couple times. That's life in the fast lane. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We'll be back again next week. I'm going to post you can get the replay on this. Go to PRN.FM, where all my shows are stored, and we will see you next week in a democracy. We hope. Thank you, guys. See you next
week. Of Eden. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia? Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Will we bit that apple? The garden was lost, and so we had to work.